What's up, gamers, and welcome to Lost at Sea Gaming. I am Hulking Yoda, the captain of this ship, the SS Gamer. And you have just stepped inside my captain's quarters, my weekly gaming update show where I talk about my favorite gaming news topic of the past week, discuss what games I've been playing, give tips on some of those games, as well as issue a weekly relevant gaming-related decree. This week, it's all about my excitement for Star Wars Outlaw. So let's talk about it and dive right into the episode with my news catch of the week. Gamers, it may not be the first time that we're hearing about Star Wars Outlaw. That happened last month at the showcase events that we witnessed. But this past week at San Diego Comic-Con, we did get some new details, a lot of really good juicy details for Star Wars Outlaws. Now, if you've listened to my show, you'll know that I'm a massive Star Wars fan. I absolutely love this franchise, have my entire life. And I feel like it's a great time to be a Star Wars fan and a gamer, because once LucasArts, Lucasfilm, once they were able to sever that tie to EA as the only publisher who could develop games for Star Wars, I think it's opened up so many great possibilities and amazing adventures that we can have from a gaming standpoint going forward. Because when it was just EA, I mean, we either didn't get anything or we got not the greatest stuff. I mean, here recently we've gotten some great additions in Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor. If you want my thoughts on Jedi Survivor, check out my review. It's right here on the channel. Bottom line is, I think that when you open it up to allow more people, the more access you allow to your property, and the more, it can go both ways, I guess. I'm sitting here kind of debating with myself, but bottom line, you could go either way. If you open it up for more people, you could therefore tend to open it up for more failures or more disasters, but it could also mean that you have more variety and more successes. So I think in this situation and this current environment, I really do feel like it is really more for the latter. It means more success, because Ubisoft Massive is the developer on Star Wars Outlaws. And man, some of the stuff we're going to talk about here has just got me so excited to get my hands on a controller and finally play this game. You know, I saw the trailer for it when it was first debuted, thought it looked amazing, couldn't wait to get my hands on a controller. Then the very next, you know, few days later, they show a new trailer with different gameplay and things like that, and I was even more excited. And now, just reading about some of the details of the things you can do. So gamers, this game, I'll just say it right out the gate, it's not even supposed to come out until next year, 2024, hopefully sometime in the earlier portion of that year. So we still got a good bit of ways to go. I mean, I can't believe I'm about to say this. I get it. It is almost August of 23. So we don't have a whole lot left in this year. And if it is in that earlier portion of 24, man, I am just extremely jacked to get my hands on it and play it. And I feel like at that point, there'd be a good enough separation of time between finishing Fallen Order and being able to jump back into that galaxy far, far away. Now, the timeline setting of this game, if you didn't know, is actually set between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. So we are right at the height of the Empire. I mean, just right in the middle of the Civil War of the galaxy between the Republic, or what used to be the Republic. The Rebellion is now really better what it's known as, and the Empire. And what better time for those known as scoundrels than in the middle of a war? Because, I mean, you can take advantage of both sides that way and make a ton of profit. So we then get to the main character of this game, the protagonist, and she is very much a scoundrel. Her name is Kay Vess. And with her comes a brand new side character. I mean, I feel like Star Wars is kind of synonymous from the movies, and especially the more recent games like the Jedi games. Cal, he has BD-1. Well, Kay, she is going to have Nix, who's this adorable-looking alien animal that belongs to a species known as Markhaal. And Nix is pretty much like a companion to Kay, and during gameplay, just like with BD-1, the player is going to be able to prompt Nix to perform certain actions that's going to help Kay out in her progression of an environment, and looks pretty cool, some of the stuff that Nix can do at this point. So, haven't really seen a whole lot of craziness outside of, you know, hey, go to this area, distract this guard, activate this switch, that kind of stuff. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more options once we get into the game, but that's what we've seen so far. Now, again, Kay is a scoundrel, a smuggler, gun for hire, mercenary, whatever adjective you want to give her. So she is going to take all the help she can get to ensure the completion of her job. So she is very much appreciative of Nix. Plus, I'm sure it's the way we all look at our own pets, whether it's cats, dogs, whatever. I'm sure that's how Nyx is to her, part of the family. Very, very curious to see how that relationship is going to be once I get into the game. Now, these jobs that she's looking to complete, they are going to require us as the players to explore new planets and the lowest levels of each planet's criminal underworld. And traveling to and from these different planets, we're going to be in Kay's customizable starship, the Trailblazer. And the Trailblazer, it sounds awesome because from what we found out this past week, it's a character in and of itself is what the development team at Ubisoft Massive is going for. They want it to be a ship that you can walk around in, you can talk to NPCs, it feels lived in because, as they put it, a ship is a smuggler or a scoundrel's home. So this needs to be furnished as such and treated as such, and just the customization options. We didn't get a whole lot of details of what those options are going to be, but I can only imagine it's going to probably run the gamut of paint jobs or maybe some different designs for, you know, fins or, you know, the way that the viewport looks. I mean, I have no idea. I don't know if it's internal and external only, internal. I have no idea yet. Haven't gotten those details. Just know that it is customizable. So the fact that you do have some sense of ownership over it in that way is enough for me, to be honest. Even if it's just a paint job, I'm fine with that. Now, this starship, the Trailblazer, it's not just for traveling to and from planets or engaging with NPCs and your crew as you're in between missions. It's also a means for dogfighting in space, those ship-to-ship battles. And I mean, as if you've seen the trailers, which if you haven't, I highly recommend checking them out because they're just so awesome. They are very much looking to be very engaging. So you have ship battles that are going to be in the atmosphere of a planet, right outside the atmosphere of it, or in the middle of deep space. However it comes to you, there are multiple ways to take out enemies. You got rapid fire turrets, you got torpedoes, you got all kinds of stuff. So it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun control wise, you know, doing all these different barrel rolls and kind of evasive maneuvers. This game looks like, and you'll see what I'm saying too more and more as I go through some of the details here that I want to cover. It just seems like it's an all-in-one package and in the best possible way. I mean, already we're talking about the exploration aspect of things and traveling to multiple planets. You got the customization options on the ship and ship battles so far. So as you're going through these planets, you are also going to be having a ton of dialogue exchanges that are going to all have, most of them at least, branching dialogue options with NPCs. And a lot of these are going to include crime bosses of the many syndicates that you find around the galaxy. Now, there are many syndicates that if you know Star Wars lore or have been around and know some of the, you know, have seen the shows and the movies, you'll probably recognize some of the syndicates that are listed, but there are also brand new syndicates that Ubisoft Massive has created for this game. So there's a lot of new faces as well as a lot of familiar faces like Jabba the Hutt. So one of the key things that was kind of notated this past week was the fact that, yeah, you do jobs for Jabba the Hutt in this game. I mean, that's what you are. You're a scoundrel. You run these jobs for people. And guess what? Jabba the Hutt, he owns the crime and the syndicate space, if you will, all in and around Tatooine and in all kinds of different areas. Bottom line is you work for Jabba and they also let you know, or let us know as the players. And you could also betray him if you're feeling a little brave there. But just keep in mind, it's going to have repercussions. And I love hearing that because it's not just a matter of black and white, you can or can't. You do it. You can do it. But you're going to have to pay for it potentially in some way later on in the game. And I'm very interested to see how those kinds of decisions and repercussions affect the game and the gameplay and potentially even the story. Like, are there going to be multiple endings to the story or multiple outcomes to certain characters within the story? Those details we haven't gotten yet either, but I'm assuming so. If it's something to the effect of, oh, you can actually betray him and there's repercussions, if they've gone to the length of making sure there's repercussions for your actions, I do feel like there's going to be those details in there where it's going to be that cause and effect of affecting characters and maybe relationships with characters, that kind of thing. So I can't wait to see more on that. Now, exploration is not just done traveling from planet to planet in space or within just the confined city streets of like Coruscant or even Tatooine. These planets that Kay is going to visit, they all have these massive open valleys and landscapes to traverse on. And to do that, to get around quickly, she is going to be using her fully customizable land speeder. Now, we did see some of this in the announcement trailer, as well as in the more recent one. And in both, the speeder is not just about getting from point A to B. On the way from point A to B, you're going to encounter enemies on other speeder bikes that are trying to chase you down and shoot at you. And as we saw in the trailer, there's just going to be different combat interactions and scenarios on that speeder bike as well. Now, one thing, again, I'm really excited about with the speeder bike is the customization options. So again, don't know the level of detail that you can get to with those options, but I'm again assuming it's going to be paint jobs and maybe where the handles are and the shape of the front or the back or how thing. I'm sure it's those basic kind of customization options, but I can tell you right now, I really hope this game has a photo mode, which we haven't heard confirmation of yet. But the reason, one reason I say that, there's so many reasons for this game to have a photo mode, but one reason is because just, putting out there online on the Instagram account or the Twitter account, the old, hey, this is my land speeder. This is my K's land speeder. And seeing all the different varieties that people are able to put together and customize and put out there, I just think that's going to be a lot of fun. So you have a lot of great means of fun ways to traverse this game world, whether it's in space from planet to planet or across the world's vast landscapes on a land speeder, obviously by, walking around, running around as well. But the details I want to talk about next are the worlds themselves. Now, there are going to be new worlds created just for this game. Lucasfilm actually told Ubisoft Massive, hey, we encourage you to create new places, new planets, new moons for players and Star Wars fans to explore and to go to. And I love that because, especially with Jedi Survivor, there was a couple of new planets that we've never actually really either visually seen or never even knew existed before Jedi Survivor. And I loved absorbing and eating up all of that newness because a lot of the same planets, don't get me wrong, Coruscant and Tatooine, they're going to be in this game. They're in just about every Star Wars story in some way, shape, or form. They're very vital, and they're very much, Mos Eisley spaceport. It's a spaceport, so everybody kind of travels to and through there, and I get it. But it's also nice to have brand new locations to go to and brand new visuals. And I love the approach that Ubisoft Massive is taking with their worlds. So the moon Tashara, for instance, this is one of the new areas that you can go to for the first time ever. It's created just for this game in Star Wars lore. And what I thought was really interesting was how the design director for the game said that they took inspiration from real locations. This is for every new world or moon in the game. But they took inspiration from real locations, and then they kind of added this alien aspect or otherworldly aspect to them to kind of differentiate them from our own world. So, for instance, East African savannas were an inspiration for the base landscape of what Tashara would ultimately become. And then they just kind of added, their own kind of science fiction-y, I'll call it, aspects around the planet or the moon. So I think that's awesome. I just cannot wait to see what kind of planets other than Tashara and these other new worlds that we get to explore. Not to mention, they did say that you are fully able to explore Tatooine. Not to mention, of course, the desert. We see a lot of the desert, but they even said it. Most Star Wars fans are probably going to be very excited and antsy and just be like, look, man, if we're on Tatooine, we have got to go or be able to have access to the Mos Eisley Cantina. And this is an open world game, so it's set up in that style. So yes, you can walk the streets of Tatooine and walk down those steps and into the Mos Eisley Cantina. Gamers, as a Star Wars fan, that is awesome. Just thinking about walking in there and the timeline that it's set in, it's just like, man, are they going to do some cool Easter eggs and have some cool characters that are sitting at the bar or at a table in the corner? Or my mind runs rampant. And I think about the bar that they have in Jedi Survivor, and I think about that on a bigger scale for Mos Eisley Cantina and how they could really do an awesome job and how cool it could be, in my mind at least, for Star Wars Outlaws. So just the fact that you talk about the intricate details of these different cities, like the Mos Eisley Cantina and the spaceport around it, that whole little city into it of itself. And then you hop on your speeder bike and you and Kay and Nyx, you just drive out to Jabba's palace and pick up a job for Jabba the Hutt, and then maybe go out into the sand dunes and go after the sand people, or find some Jawas to do a job for, and the sand crawler that they're going through. There's so many possibilities in an open world Star Wars game, and thinking of what possibilities lie ahead. And I know I was saying I'm excited to see new worlds, and I'm sitting here being a fanboy about Tatooine, but that just tells you I am going to put some serious hours into this game, which leads me to this last point here that I thought was an interesting one. Ubisoft Massive did make sure to point out and clarify, because they were asked about the length of the game, and it's like, hey, so this is an open world game. It's kind of got a lot of RPG elements. A lot of games nowadays, you know, are 500 hours long. Ubisoft specifically is known for extremely long games like Valhalla and the Far Cry series. Is Star Wars Outlaws going to be this massive multi-hundred hour game? And honestly, gamers, I was very relieved with what the response was that Ubisoft Massive gave to the interviewer. And they said, look, it is an open world game, but our development team has worked to really tightly wind the narrative experience to where there is, don't get us wrong, a ton for you to do and get sidetracked on and do other than the main story, but it's not going to be to the extent where players are not going to have to put in an insane amount of time to complete and see everything. It's within a good, solid amount of time, but not nothing crazy. So in my opinion, I think that it's probably going to be comparable to Jedi Survivor, in my opinion. I just recently, when I finished the game a couple months ago, to get the platinum in that game and to do everything it had on offer, it was roughly close to 80 hours that I spent in that game. My wife was very similar to that same time frame. So if Star Wars Outlaws ends up being a game that lasts for 70 to 80 hours, I'm perfectly okay with that. I'm just happy and excited that it's not going to be 200-300 hours long, because, man, I'll talk about that later on in the episode too. But it was a nice kind of a sigh of relief a little bit to be like, okay, it's a good solid length, but it's not too crazy. So as far as Star Wars Outlaws is concerned, again, it's not out until next year, but man, just already, I've only known of its existence for about a month and a half now, and I am just so excited to play this game, get lost in its world, see more details on it, and obviously I will keep you continually updated with my excitement around this game, and when it comes out, my first impressions, I cannot wait. I can't wait to see what other Star Wars games are coming out that we don't know about yet. There's just a lot to be excited for when it comes to being a Star Wars fan, and Star Wars Outlaws is right up there at the top for me. So that's this week's Catch of the Week. Now let's open up my captain's log and see what games I've been playing. Gamers, since last week's episode, I have played a ton of the one game that has consumed my soul since its release back in June, and that is, of course, Final Fantasy 16. Gamers, when last I left you with my progress in Final Fantasy 16, I was but at a measly 62 hours in the game. Well, over the course of the past week, I was able to put in a staggering 18 hours into this game, bringing me to a total of, you guessed it, 80 hours total. So I've now crossed that 80-hour threshold, which is a big milestone for me. Typically in these kinds of games, every 10 hours is like, oh man, another 10 hours. That's pretty awesome. But especially to get to 80 hours, it's kind of a double meaning for me here with this game specifically, because if you've been listening to my show for probably a little over a month and a half now since the game released and I've been discussing my playthrough of it, you will know that I have stated that I thought the game was going to probably take me right around 80 hours and I would be done with it. Not the platinum or anything like that. I'm not doing a platinum pursuit for this game because of that pesky new game plus and playing through it a second time. 99% of the time, I don't typically do that, play through games on New Game Plus. So especially in a game like this and this size, I was like, nah, I'm not doing that. So I'm not going after the platinum, but I still do want to get as many trophies as possible while playing the game. But the reason why it's also important to me, if you look at the calendar, we are just a couple days away from August, the month of August, and I'd wanted to be complete with this game by August, so I had a month of August
to be able to go back and play through and finish up the expansion for Horizon Forbidden West, you know, Burning Shores, as well as play through the rest of Hogwarts Legacy, which is from way earlier, it feels like forever ago, in the beginning of this year. Absolutely loved that game. I had to step away from it because Dead Space drew me in and I had to focus on it. And next thing you know, there's Resident Evil 4 releasing before I could finish Hogwarts, and Jedi Survivor, now Final Fantasy 16. It was just one thing after another there for about a month. Every other month, it seemed like there was something else. Well, here we are, Final Fantasy 16, 80 hours in. If you'll remember from last week, the progress tracker on the PS5 said I was 76% complete with the story, the main story in the game. Well, in that 18 hours, you might think like, man, that's about the length of kind of an average game back in the day, and even close to the average length of most games nowadays. And you only progressed 10%? Yep. 86% is where I am now. 10% completion over the course of those 18 hours. And I mean, to be honest with you, the last play session I had the entire day to myself, gamers. And I spent about 7 hours in a singular day, off and on, cumulatively 7 hours playing Final Fantasy 16. And in that entire 7 hours, all I did was side content. So that explains to you why in 18 hours of play, out of that 18 hours, guaranteed, I would say more than half of that time was just doing side content. And I'm going to get into the details of what that side content was here in just a sec. But first, I really want to pick up where I left off when last I was playing and kind of talk about the main story stuff here first. Spoiler free, of course. Now, when I first started playing this past week, I started out in the Warehouse District, and I had to progress through it, go through some battles. There were some interesting story moments that happened, some fun boss fights, and that was basically all we did at the Warehouse. Well, after doing that, you go back to the Hideaway, and that's obviously your hub in between every main mission. You go back here, you collect new side quests, you pick up new hunts from the hunt board, all the things I've been talking about for all these weeks now. So that's what I did. I came back to the Hideaway, took care of some things like crafting and upgrading a new sword, which is the Rune Sword +2. And some of the side content, which I'll get to in a sec, I did pretty quickly move back on to the main story. And man, gamers, woo! It was arguably the most epic yet main story portion of this game, and that says a lot, because there has been a ton of just absolute epicness in this game. One of the reasons I love it so much, but this was just, man, the story, the weight of the story, the epicness of the details of what happened over the course of these few hours of that main story progression, the boss fights that you do, the locations that you go to, even just the normal going from point A to B to get to the boss fights, the enemies, the location itself. Like, I just can't explain to you how amazing it was, because I'd have to go into all the details of what happened. I'm not going to do that to you listeners. So let me just say, it was an amazing part of the main story, and just this main story is just, oh my god, I can't say it enough how much I love this story, these characters, and what Square Enix has done. Like, this is just awesome. Like, the guys or gals or singular people, whoever it is that came up with this story and wrote it, man, they're awesome. I mean, they just know how to write a good story. So after I did this, let me just say that after all was said and done with the main quest and what I did in it, I walked away with a newfound respect for King Barnabas of Walud, the kingdom of Walud, which is situated, or basically what's left of the entire continent of Ash. And there are only two continents that are pretty much the main focal point of the story here in Valestia, which is the game's overall world. So you have the continent of Storm and the continent of Ash. The King Barnabas and army of Walud and all that, they come from Ash. So anyways, there's stuff that goes on there. Let me just say, King Barnabas, newfound respect, just to reiterate. So really, really enjoyed what was going on there. So that's the main story portions of what I had done this past week. Now, when we get to the side quests and all the side content that I did, Well, first off, I'm going to start with exploring that Velcroid Desert. I feel like every week I'm talking to you guys about something new that I've done in the Velcroid Desert. And it just goes back to show what I was saying from the beginning, where the Velcroid Desert was just massive. And when you first get there, there are multiple branching paths and sections of it that are inaccessible to you. You have to either do certain side quests or progress enough in the main story to unlock access to these areas. So I have pretty much, at this point now, I can tell you, looking back at my entirety of play, that I have unlocked the entirety of the Velcroid Desert and that entire map, all the pathways, everywhere you can go to. So I've explored it in its entirety. So that's what I did this past week. And there wasn't a ton left for me to unlock and to see, but what was left was just awesome. So as part of that, of course, there are many of the different Notorious Mark hunts that I've talked about that you pick up from the hunting board and kind of decipher where the location is based on what the description is they give you on the hunting board. Well, there was a few hunts that I did that I was out there in the Velcroid Desert doing, as well as a multitude of side quests, gamers, just a ton of all the different, there's a ton of villages spread throughout this area, and I had multiple side quests from each village, to be honest with you. And there was a new smithing town of Dravosht is the name of it. And it actually was part of a string of side quests that just culminate in a really, really nice prize for you as the player. I'll just put it to you that way. It's a weapon. It's one that you're going to be very excited, as I was, when you get it. And, I hate the fact that I received this prize and weapon, and it was at the very end of my final play session before I had to record, because I'm like, man, I really, really want to see how much damage this bad boy does in action. But regardless, very, very cool quest line. And, you know, I was brought to Dravosht because of the quest line for Blackthorn. And Blackthorn, he is a character who was the Hideaway's resident blacksmith. And it was just kind of awesome to look at a different side of him, as well as into a bit of his past, because the whole game he's been this kind of like gruff, kind of a dick, to be honest with you. And you get to see why if you go on these multiple quests throughout this questline thread. And it's very much worth it. Not just for the story, not just for the end prize, but it was just, overall, there were so many things that made it satisfying. I mean, it was awesome. And that's one thing that I have loved about a lot of the side quests that I've done this past week, is that most of them were either very purposeful to either the stories of an individual character or a group of characters, as well as some that were important to the future of the game world of Valestia, as its people are currently in the game trying to seek to rebuild and defend itself against the blight that is spreading ever quicker across the continent of Storm and making its way from Ash and just kind of enveloping Storm at this point. So it's this, what they're calling, it's an ether flood. And I've mentioned it before in my captain's quarters, and ether is essentially an energy force that emanates from crystals, and it's kind of also just in the air to a lower volume. But when the mother crystals are being destroyed, as the main story has you doing, the ether in the air is being increased, and it's dangerous and toxic to just regular humans. And there's only so much that humans or any living creature can sustain until it gets transformed and turned into these kind of mindless, aggressive, zombie-like creatures. And it just keeps slowly as a wave, or as the characters in the game world call it, a flood, an ether flood. It just continuously is moving across the land and enveloping and taking over villages and just different locations. It's just all really, really cool. Now, there was also two side quests that I did for two other different characters that live in the Hideaway. One was a botanist and the other is kind of an inventor of sorts. And completing these quests, they allowed me to upgrade all of my potions and curative items to max potency, which is obviously awesome, as well as max out my inventory space to carry max quantity of each. So completing those quests was really big for me because, one, there's a trophy when you max out these two things. It's one trophy for maxing out both. So I got that trophy, so that was always cool. But it was also nice to have that added increased inventory quantity and the potency as well. So I have absolutely loved what I have done. One of the biggest things that I did this past week, though, that was a huge milestone for me was defeating Zvarog, who, if you'll remember from the previous episode, he's that crafty S-ranked red dragon that was the notorious mark from a board that I shared with you last week that kicked my butt. So this week, I gave it a couple more tries, still took a few more tries, but I was successful in finally defeating him. And it was close. I'll say that. It was close, down to the wire, but I did it. I was the one left standing when it was all said and done. So I was very excited about that. I also finally stumbled across the game's Chronoliths, which I'll get more into in my highlight of the week and my buried treasure. All that's kind of tied together with Chronoliths. So anyways, absolutely amazing time in Final Fantasy 16 this past week. Even though it wasn't a ton of main story progression, what was the main story progression that I did was amazing. And everything else was just so good and such top quality and so enjoyable that I don't even care. I don't even care at this point that I'm probably definitely not going to be beating this game by August 1st of 2023. It's probably going to lean more into mid-August to late August. And I don't even know if I'm going to be able at this point to have time to finish up Hogwarts Legacy before Starfield on September 1st. But it's all good. I'm not worried about it. I'm not rushing this game. I am choosing to continue enjoying living in Valestia. So that was this week's Catch of the Week. Now, out of all of those 18 hours, let's go find out what this week's highlight of the week was. Gamers, this past week in my journeys through Final Fantasy XVI's world of Valestia, I came across some new optionable things to do. And that one, we'll say quest line of things to do, are the game's chronoliths. And these chronoliths are, think about like tall, narrow statues or just rocks, really, that have certain recessed designs carved into them. And I honestly never noticed them during my first pass by, if they were even there in certain areas where they're located in the game. But apparently after a certain point in the game's story, the main story, once you get to that point, these obelisks, in a way, these stone structures, they will light up. And at that point, it means that you are able to interact with them. So you can go up to them, interact with them, and ultimately it will bring you to this stage or area where you can perform the challenge of that respective chronolith. Now, there are 7 total chronoliths in the game, each one that are specific to an icon or the abilities of an icon in the game. Now, the one that I did this past week, I just kind of stumbled across it. I was walking around and I was exploring the Northern Valkyrie Desert, as I stated earlier in my captain's log. And as I came across this stone, I thought it was just another either obelisk, or there is a stone that you can go to the Halls of Virtue and you can practice your different combat moves and replay certain stages for higher scores and things like that. I thought it was one of those that I did feel as I was going up to it, man, it's kind of odd because, you know, out in the world to have one of these here, you know, the only place I had seen it before was at the Hideaway. So obviously, as I got closer and I examined it, I realized that it was a chronolith. And me and my wife had just talked about, you know what, we haven't even done a chronolith yet. What is a chronolith? And we didn't want to look it up online because we didn't want to have any potential spoilers come our way. So it was kind of cool for me just the way I discovered it, as just kind of stumbling across it, exploring the world. Well, the set of challenges that I got was the one for Titan and his abilities, the Earthen abilities. And oh man, I got to tell you, it took me roughly close to an hour and a half of time to finally be successful in this. And that is one reason why it is my highlight of the week, because man, it just took some replayability, some repetition, some muscle memory, some strategy, trial and error, figuring out what works best. And I'll get to that in my next segment of my buried treasure and give you some tips on how I suggest to defeat this challenge. But man, it was awesome tenfold, because these chronoliths are on a timer and you only have a certain amount of time and able in order to defeat these enemies or enemy and in the form of a boss at the end of it. And I ended up completing this challenge finally with 2 seconds left. So for me,
that was an amazing feeling to get that final hit go through and the game kind of freeze and pause and go into the animation of having defeated an enemy. I'm like, yes, I literally screamed out, woohoo. Oh man, I was so excited. So that was easily for me, my highlight of this past week is not only completing the Chronolith set of challenges for, you know, Titan's abilities, but also the fact that I was able to do it with just 2 seconds to spare. Very good feeling. Now let's open up a chest of buried treasure gaming tips I have for you in Final Fantasy 16. Gamers, I really thought nothing else was going to be able to top my desire to give you some strategies and tips when going against specifically the Earthen Chronolith, the one that is located in the Northern Velcroite Desert. Very tip-top. If you go to that map or that portion of the map in the Velcroite Desert, it will be kind of like almost a narrow passageway, the way it's kind of outlined on the map. And then it is right there in the very back corner. You'll see it once you get close enough. So when you get to the Chronolith, there are actually 4 different stages for you to complete. Now, at least in the Earthen Chronolith, there are 3 stages of 3 waves of enemies in each stage, as well as a boss that you have to fight and defeat on the 4th stage. Now, that is, again, I don't know if that's just standard across all Chronoliths. As I stated earlier, it's the only Chronolith and the first one that I've come across so far in the game. So there may be different amounts of waves of enemies or different amount of stages, depending on which Chronolith you're doing. But this is the setup for me in the Earthen Chronolith. So specifically, I will be referencing that, as well as giving you some suggestions on how I was able to defeat it and how I think it's going to be best and most possible for you to be able to be successful here. Now, as I stated earlier, you are on a timer. So you get a certain set time when you start out the first challenge and the first wave and the first stage. And obviously the idea is to take out these enemies as quickly as possible. Now you don't have just the timer counting down. You do have the ability to add time back to your overall time. And the way you do this is based on the attacks that you use in combat. Whether it's using special abilities that are tied to that specific Chronolith, like in this case, the Titan abilities, or just special abilities in general, I notice those give you more time. Connecting combos, stringing them together, defeating enemies, all these different things. And it gives you, I mean, I think it's awesome the way Square Enix has this set up, is because before you actually choose to start the stage, it'll give you a layout of everything. It shows you the abilities that you're going to be using and required to use, because there is only a specific abilities that you can use in this challenge as well, on these Chronoliths as well. So you have to use the abilities that they are providing you, and you have to defeat all these enemies and all these stages within a time limit. And the time limit carries over from stage to stage. So even though stage 1 has 3 waves, stage 2, 3 waves, stage 3, 3 waves, and then the boss in stage 4, that timer that starts at the beginning, whatever you carry over stage to stage, that is what you have. You also have no access to healing items, no potions, no high potions, no stone skin tonics to increase or boost your defense, none of that stuff. So you have to maintain your health and be quick enough in taking out all these enemies and the boss at the end in order to be successful. So it sounds pretty daunting, and it can be if you're not well prepared for it or approaching it in the right way. Now, my suggestion to you for this one specifically, do not sleep on the Titan Block ability. This is an ability that for me is designated to the circle button. And if you time it perfectly, there's a perfect block and you can do an immediate parry by tapping real quick the square button. And that'll initiate some very quick and very powerful punches from Clive to the enemies that you're fighting. Now, and you also get a massive boost, sometimes up to 11 seconds worth of time added back to your clock counter. So I would highly suggest using that Titan Block. I mean, just absolutely use that more often than not. I would say use that over your normal R1 to evade, because you do get time added back to your overall timer for doing the evade, but not as much as you do for utilizing that Titan Block, because the game gives you more time for using the designated abilities for the Chronolith theme that you're going after. So again, this is Earthen, it's Titan. So the more you use those abilities, the more time you get. So the 2 abilities they give you, in addition to the Titan Block, use those as much as possible. There is a cooldown, so obviously you gotta wait and use other things in between, but use them as much as possible. As far as healing, do not sleep on your limit break. Keep an eye on that. Keep it charging and getting as full as possible as often as possible. And as soon as it fills up and is maxed out, I would recommend going ahead and using it, because you're only going to be wasting attacks and the opportunities to fill it back up as you continue to fight and take damage and or however it continues. So I would consider keeping that going as often as possible, just to kind of keep your health up. If you do all these things and you utilize all these and use the upheaval ability, is just a huge opportunity to wipe out multiple enemies for the most part at once. And there are many waves that have groups of enemies that are pretty lower health, so you can take them out pretty quick with an upheaval if you position yourself correctly to where Clive attacks them and can take all of them on at once. You might have to add a couple of hits here or there with your sword afterwards, but I mean, if you have 10 enemies and you take out 7 of them and you just have to hit each of the other 3 remaining enemies once with your sword, not too bad in my opinion. So if you do these things, I personally believe, I mean, hey, I did make it out there with only 2 seconds left. Maybe you'll be able to do it quicker than me, but I was successful. So I did at least want to share with you how I was able to be successful in this chronolith. Now, for the first time in a very long time, let's go check out my latest accessory review.
Accessory review.
Gamers, I can't believe it's taken this long for me to finally do this accessory review for you for the Starfield controller. Because it's been over a month since it released and was shown off, and since I've had it. As soon as they showed it off, I could not hesitate, I could not wait to immediately purchase both that and the headset, which I will have a headset accessory review next week on next week's Captain's Quarters. But for this week, we're focusing on the controller. And if you have listened to this show long enough, you know I consider myself the controller freak. I mean, I've done whole episodes just about the evolution of controllers, the Xbox evolution of its controller, the PlayStation's evolution of its controller. Check those episodes out if you're interested. But when it came to the Starfield controller, first off, I got to talk about aesthetics. That's the first thing I'm going to talk about. And ultimately, just to give you a heads up, the review, the score is, if you want to call it that, it's not really a numbered score. It's a rating. And what I do for accessory reviews, basically I say, is it an absolute must-have purchase, regardless of your collector or not? You got to get this. Or is it a purchase that's really just about a collector's piece? Or just keep it moving. Move on. Don't even worry about it. It's not really going to set your world on fire if you don't have this controller. So, as we look at the aesthetics of the Starfield controller, first off, let me just say that the robot white that they use for the base color of it is really just a beautiful, gorgeous white. And accenting off of that is everything else that they have that Bethesda has created this controller with. And it's just awesome. All around the different D-pad and face buttons and even the view and menu buttons, everything kind of has like a circle around it. And then there's different right angles and different lines pointing to maybe a description, ignition, or, you know, words like that. Something that would be relatable to a spaceship or a control panel of a spaceship. And that's essentially what I consider Bethesda was going for in the creation of this controller. And it's awesome because it just adds some personality to the controller, is the way I feel about it. And then there's just these different designs and shapes that are kind of around the analog sticks and, again, the face buttons and just everything around it. And then you have that beautiful rainbow constellation logo. Now, Constellation is the name of the company that you're supposed to be working for, the head of all of the purpose behind space exploration and whatnot, as far as I can understand it so far, of what I've seen in previews and whatnot in the game. And their logo or their color scheme is kind of this rainbow of different colors. And that is around the Xbox guide button there in the top center of the controller. And it just looks great. It fades out of that and kind of cuts off at an angle. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful design. The colors accent again well off of each other. The analog sticks are a nice, beautiful light gray, and they accent well off of the white. The D-pad is this just a beautiful gold color. And my favorite part about it aesthetically is the triggers. When you get to the triggers, they are actually, for the first time ever in an Xbox controller, they are clear. So you see the inner workings of those triggers on the back end of the controller, and that's just, I absolutely love it. It's my favorite feature of the controller. And then on the back side, there is this just kind of a sharp red with, on the battery pack cover, the Constellation logo And then there's some words on the inside. I'll let you experience that as you have that as a surprise. I'll leave one last surprise for you. But in general, aesthetically, I mean, it's just an absolutely gorgeous controller to look at. And, you know, you're just, if you're like me, you're playing your game and you glance down every once in a while at your controller and it's just kind of like, man, that's a nice piece of controller. Now, the way it feels just like any other Xbox Series controller, which is a good thing because those controllers are awesome. Only barely edged out, in my opinion, by the DualSense controller on the PS5. But when it comes to this controller specifically, it is one of the few that are actually increasing in number as we speak. One of the few Xbox controllers that has rubberized grips as part of its customization. And I love the rubberized grips. Let me just say that. The Lunar Shift controller that I'd reviewed months ago, that has the rubberized grips. This has the rubberized grips. The Xbox 20th anniversary controller. So I have three controllers now that have those rubberized grips. And believe it or not, they do make a difference. Now, the regular edges that the Xbox has on the plastic side of things on the regular controllers, those are still great as far as from a grip standpoint, but they're nowhere near as amazing as those rubberized grips. So from a feel standpoint, everything feels excellent, as any Xbox controller does, and then it has that added pop to it with the rubberized grips. So overall, what is my rating of this controller? Do I think that you have to get it regardless? Or is it just for collectors, or should you just keep it moving and not even worry about it? Gamers, my review for this controller, the Starfield Limited Edition controller, is an absolute must-buy. This is just, it hits all the right boxes for me. All the boxes are checked off. Beautiful design, it looks great, it feels great, it controls great, and it does some unique things. The clear controller triggers, I think that is awesome. So, all in all, awesome controller. Absolutely love it. Highly recommend you picking one up if you're looking forward to playing Starfield or just in general. If you're looking for a new controller, can't go wrong with this one. So that's my latest accessory review. Again, next week, check back and see what my thoughts were on the Starfield headset. Now let's go check out this week's Captain's Decree. Gamers, this week for Captain's Decree, Star Wars Outlaws got me thinking. The developer is making that statement about, oh, don't worry, the game's not going to be some unfinishable 200-300-hour game. It got me thinking, and this is this week's Captain's Decree, I am getting so excited more and more to play shorter games going forward. And let me just clarify, when I say shorter games, I mean shorter games for me, which means less than 100 hours. So I know that I just got done talking about this episode of hitting 80 hours in Final Fantasy, and you know, I'm loving living in it, and I can't wait to continue living in it, and that's true. But I am honest that, you know, going forward, looking ahead, it's like, man, you know, 80 hours is kind of a sweet spot for me anymore at this point in my gaming life, because the way my work-life balance is, and you know, sharing life with kid and wife and everything else, there's only so much time in a day in a given week. And as much as I love gaming, I mean, everything else kind of comes first, right? So you only have so much hours that you can give to that passion in a given week, or at least I do. So I try to give as much as I can, but man, it's not like it was 20 years ago when I was a teenager and, you know, a bachelor, and it was just me, you know. I also don't have the kind of energy to where I can stay up as late as I used to be able to, have as much lack of sleep as I used to, and be able to go off of 4 hours, 3 hours of sleep, and you know, after having been up all night gaming, I can't do it anymore, gamers, and it sucks to admit that. But because of that, man, I have to start looking at these longer experiences, and I get it, Starfield, I'm talking about it, I'm definitely playing it, I'm definitely getting it come September 1st, but we all know it's a Bethesda RPG. Those games, you can spend hundreds of hours in them. Now, I'm not saying that I would spend 200-300 hours in Starfield, but I know me. I do tend to get lost in the games that I play when it's that open. So I know that I could easily spend anywhere from 100 to 200 hours playing this game. And I'm sure I'll love all of it, but it's just like, man, I'm looking ahead, and something like Star Wars Outlaws, and I think about Jedi Survivor, right, that I just got a platinum in, spent 80 hours, got the platinum, boom, amazing experience. I think of Dead Space, 40 hours. The Callisto Protocol, it took me just over 20 hours. The Resident Evil 4 remake, it was around 40-ish hours. My point is, for me, I think my preferred perfect game length
right now in my life is around 40 to 50 hours. Anything over that, I would say that 50 to 80 hours is not too bad. I'm down with that. But anything over 80, when you start getting into, especially over 100 hours, is where I'm just like, man, dude, I'm going to have to start really picking and choosing my experiences, because I there's too many experiences and games coming in the future that I want to play that I don't want to not play in order to spend the extra 50, 60 hours in another experience that I've already started. So if you could follow me there, and if that makes sense, just hearing developers, and it's not just Ubisoft Massive with Star Wars Outlaws most recently. That was just the most recent example. But I have seen a lot of that more recently of like, yeah, you know, we don't, it seems that developers are trying to still keep things open and have a lot of content available, but not go nuts with it. Like it seems like happened for a long time in gaming. So I'm just kind of excited to be, because it, for me, what it excites for me is the fact that I can potentially have more options and more opportunities to play more games and complete more games. That's the other key to it, is obviously I think most of us would agree when we start a game, as long as we like it and it's not trash, the intent is to complete the game, right? So it would be nice to kind of have a good completion percentage, because if you listen to my year-end review episode at the beginning of this year, looking back at 2022, woo, I played a ton of games, but I didn't beat a whole lot. I didn't complete a whole lot. So that bothered me, to be honest. I don't want to do that again this year. I've already done a much, much better job of actually completing most of what I've played and purchased. So I feel really good about this year already. But even looking forward to the future, and you know, you look at games like Alan Wake 2 and Alone in the Dark and even Spider-Man 2 and things like that. Okay, cool. These are probably going to be some chunk to them, but it's not going to be overweight in a sense. And that is something that I am excited about and can get behind, the opportunity to have that many more experiences possible.
That'll do it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed your time aboard the SS Gamer. You can join its crew by reaching out to me via email at lostatseagaming365@gmail.com, as well as searching for Hulking Yoda on the Xbox, PlayStation, and Nintendo Switch networks. You can also find me on social media on Instagram at lostatseagaming, as well as on Twitter at lostatseagamin, the number one. Thank you for listening, and until the sea says otherwise, we'll keep sailing.